Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hi there. I'm Rand Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Grace Wan in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, what it's like to love and leave the white evangelical church. NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon grew up as a church kid, terrified of hell and steeped in creationism. Ultimately, she left the church, and she'll tell us why and how and what she learned. Her book is The Ex-Evangelicals. Have you left a religion? Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. Sarah McCammon grew up in a white evangelical world of certainty. There was heaven, there was hell. If you believed in Jesus, you would be saved. But even as a child, doubts entered her mind. Were classmates who practiced different religions destined for hell? Was it her job to convert the girl at the skate rink? As an adult, those concerns morphed into a questioning discomfort with, and ultimately departure from, the church. That journey forms the center of her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah McCammon is an NPR political correspondent, and she joins us today. Welcome to Forum, Sarah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, you grew up in Kansas City in a family of six, your parents and three siblings. As a child, what was church like for you? Was it a comfort?
Yes and no. I mean, church was just baked into our lives. It was the weekly social event in many ways, and then we had other events that sort of centered around it. So we'd drive out to our big suburban mega church every Sunday morning. And I don't really go into this in the book, but there was one location. I lived in Kansas City, Missouri, which, if anybody has been there, is really kind of a bi-state community. The suburbs spread across the state line into Kansas. And so we would cross the state line and drive out to our big mega church campus. Later, met in another part of suburban Kansas City. But it was, you know, when I was a kid, I remember sitting in the back of the car and, you know, watching, looking out at the highway. And you know, it was just a sort of a ritual that we enjoyed. I'd go to children's church while my parents were in the main service. We'd kind of be there and, you know, sing worship songs off the overhead projector for maybe 45 minutes. Because in my tradition, worship and singing praise chorus is a big part of the service. Everybody gets together and sings. And then the kids would split off and go to the children's service, which was fun. There were puppets and stories and things like that. But it was also scary. I mean, all the messages were geared toward this same idea that everybody's souls were in peril if we didn't believe the right things, in that we needed to believe the right things and we needed to make sure that everybody else did too.
Yeah, there was a real fretfulness that steeped into the religious experience for you. And I had so much sympathy for you, young Sarah, wondering if she needed to convert people so they wouldn't end up in hell.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, that I don't even remember the first time I heard sort of the lay of the land or the state of the world as my community saw it. I just remember, and I kind of open one of the early chapters of the book in this way, I just remember so many prayers over the dinner table at night, sitting around the dinner table, praying for my grandfather to get saved, as we put it, because he was one of very few people that I knew or saw with any regularity who wasn't in this evangelical world. You know, I talk in the book about how my whole life was really church and Christian school, which was part of a different church, but everybody held very similar beliefs. And so my understanding, as it was portrayed to me from my parents, the pastor in children's church, and later my preschool teachers, kindergarten teachers, everything was about how you needed to get saved. And almost everybody that I knew, my peers in Christian school and church, had prayed what evangelicals call the prayer of salvation. You know, evangelicals put a lot of emphasis on a conversion experience, on a moment when you decide to follow Jesus and accept Jesus. You know, other Christian traditions emphasize things like baptism and confirmation and some of these rituals and ceremonies. But evangelicalism is much more kind of about your head and your heart, getting those two things right with God. And then, you know, once you've done that, sharing that message with other people. And so there was a lot of concern about having that the right ideas and the right beliefs and the right relationship to God. And then, you know, spreading that message. We believe that was what we were on earth to do.
Did your family come from a long line of evangelicals, or was this a religion that your parents found as adults? Or
no, they really didn't. I mean, my understanding of my parents' backgrounds is that my mother grew up Lutheran in the Midwest. She descended from a bunch of German immigrants in the Midwest. And just about everybody was German Lutheran certainly her grandparents' communities and even her parents to a large extent. And so for her, you know, the way she would describe it to me growing up was that she, you know, some of the people she knew were saved, but they didn't really have a relationship with Jesus the way that they should. And so it seemed like it was kind of questionable, you know, and what I understand now is that evangelicalism really put kind of a different spin or a different varnish on Protestant Christianity. It really, like I said, emphasized this idea of a personal relationship with Jesus, a personal conversion. It was about you and God. And whereas, you know, mainline Protestant traditions might talk about that, but it wasn't the same level of emphasis. And again, there was more emphasis on rituals and traditions that sort of brought you into the church community. So I think for my mother, that was the distinction for her. She would talk about finding Jesus as a teenager during a difficult time in her life when she really felt like God was reaching out to her and she had this really meaningful conversion that she felt, you know, changed her in a powerful way. My father's family was kind of WASPy and, you know, I think my grandmother had been raised Catholic, but hadn't really continued. I know my grandparents were not married in the Catholic Church, and my grandfather was from, again, more of kind of a New England WASPy family. And I don't believe that they raised their kids with any kind of serious religious tradition. I think my dad talked about occasionally going to a mainline Protestant church every now and then, but it wasn't a big emphasis. You know, my grandfather was a neurosurgeon. He was very involved in the arts in Kansas City. And I think that the focus of their lives was just very different than the focus of my childhood. And my dad, like my mom, I think they both kind of, they're baby boomers. And from what they've described to me, they had their conversion experiences as teenagers, sort of through meeting other young teenagers who were part of kind of a youth group experience and part of this kind of ascending post-Jesus people, post-hippie movement, ascending evangelicalism that was really kind of the zeitgeist of their time.
Right. The 70s going into the 80s. I mean, right. I want to just take it just a step back. I mean, you've chosen to focus on the white evangelical movement. And I wanted to ask you about your choice to focus on that in the book. And also maybe if you could help foot, what is the white evangelical movement?
I think it's important to first say that, you know, evangelicalism is a big catch-all term. It includes a lot of different sort of sub-sects and traditions within it. You know, people debate about whether, for example, charismatic Christianity, which emphasizes healing and laying hands on people and speaking in tongues and spiritual gifts, as they're called, whether that's part of evangelicalism. My church certainly merged the two. And you know, there are different and don't want to bore people, but there are different theologies, you know, within evangelicalism. Different people have different views about questions like whether or not you can ever lose your salvation if you get saved, if you accept Jesus, can you ever lose that? People have different views of those things. But broadly speaking, evangelicalism is a movement that emerged from Protestant Christianity, right? So the split between Catholic and Protestant church, you know, 500 years ago. And then evangelicalism emerged out of the Protestant stream. And it contains a lot of different, not only different ways of thinking and theologies that are sort of unified around some similar themes, but also there's racial and ethnic diversity within evangelicalism. And I chose to focus on white evangelicalism because when you talk about the American context, it's impossible to talk about religion without talking about race, and certainly the intersection between religion and culture and religion and politics. So while, you know, I've heard from people from a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds who've encountered this book and said they resonate with parts of it, I didn't want to speak beyond my own tradition. And the white evangelical tradition, you know, overwhelmingly the churches I grew up in were white, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly, the church and the school, and also, and then my evangelical college as well. And if you look at the way people vote, there are just massive differences, you know, particularly between Black and white Protestant Christians, conservative Protestant Christians. So there's a chapter in the book where I talked to several Black Christians who had spent a lot of time in evangelical spaces, including dominantly white spaces, including some places and some churches that had, you know, been part of a movement to try to diversify the church, and found that they often didn't feel included, didn't feel that their concerns and their needs and their rights were prioritized, particularly the last several years as we've seen so much, you know, division in the country and in churches over politics. But so often when journalists and demographers talk about evangelicals, particularly as a voting bloc, they're really talking about white evangelicals. And so I wanted to be clear that I'm speaking to my tradition, which again has some overlap with other traditions, but as a whole, as a group, white evangelicals vote very differently than even evangelicals of color.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. And but I mean, before the break, I just wanted to ask, you know, the term ex-evangelical, it's not something that you coined, but it's something that's used within that movement. What does that describe? People who've left the church?
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty simply, it means you were once an evangelical and now you're not for whatever reason. And it's a word that I encountered in my reporting in 2016 while reporting on the alignment of the evangelical movement with Donald Trump. And again, mostly white evangelicals with Donald Trump. And I was talking to some women about white evangelical women about their response to the Access Hollywood video in which, you know, Trump bragged about touching women in their private areas. And one of the women we interviewed for that story said she was really wrestling with the term evangelical and whether or not it applied to her. And so I started paying attention to this word ex-evangelical that I'd really never heard before that, but which felt like it applied to me in a lot of ways, too.
Well, we're talking with NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon. In 2016, she covered the Trump campaign and witnessed firsthand how he commandeered the white evangelical vote. It's a community she knows something about because she grew up and left that church. She tells that story in her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And we want to hear from you. Have you left the white evangelical church or organized religion? What were your reasons? And what have you come to learn about the education that you received within that church? If you've left a religious tradition, have you found a spiritual practice to replace it? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, Twitter or X, Instagram, or our digital community on Discord. Or you can give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. More Forum after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Vaughn, in for Mina Kim. We're talking with NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon. She has a new book called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's about her journey within and leaving that church itself, and also the things she's learned along the way. We'd love to hear from you. Have you left the white evangelical church or any organized religion? What were your reasons? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or find us on our social channels at kqed.forum, or you can give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. One of the things you talk about in your book, Sarah, is the education that you received. And as you've mentioned, you went to Christian schools, K through college, and there was a lot that you were allowed to do as a child and not allowed to do. And one of the things I thought was funny, I was reading your Substack, was Barbies were not allowed, but you had a Barbie that was Skipper, not Barbie herself. Why Skipper?
That's a great question. And I mean, this is one of those things where I have to say, like, not all evangelical kids were forbidden from having Barbie. But I mean, if most evangelical kids, I think, would have been forbidden from having certain things that, like, a lot of people of my generation couldn't watch the Smurfs for whatever reason, but some could. And it varied from family to family, even within churches. I think, it's funny. I sometimes laugh about the crossover between kind of like crunchy feminist moms and evangelical moms, because there is like an intersection there. And I think it maybe is right there with Barbie, because my mom, I think she saw Barbie as sort of promoting a vision of femininity that wasn't what she wanted to promote for her daughter, which I think is probably something that a lot of moms would sympathize with, regardless of their religious beliefs. Like, do we want our girls to feel like they have to be beautiful and perfect all the time, right? Do we want them to be hypersexualized from a young age? Yeah. No. And the reasons for that might be different reasons, but the sentiment is sort of the same. I think Skipper was okay because, frankly, she was younger and a little less va-va-voom and maybe a little more wholesome. I know it was, I really hated this as a kid, but as I look back now that I am a mother, not of girls, but I am a mother nonetheless, and I see the stress of like trying to, you want to do what's best for your kids and you're trying to sort of strike a balance. And so I see that as probably my mother's way of trying to be like, Barbie's not what we want, but here's something you can have instead. And then the Hart family came along. I don't know if you remember this, but it was this sort of niche, I think probably a response to that sentiment among some parents about Barbie being, too gaudy, too sexualized. And the Hart family was like this very wholesome, mother, father, little boy, little girl, and Mrs. Hart was dressed modestly and all this, and so I could have Hart family dolls, but yeah. No Barbie.
You describe it as Mrs. Hart was brunette instead of blonde, definitely not shacking up with Ken, and married with a couple of toddlers in the back of the Hart family's practical family car. And it just, my sister and I were laughing because she had the Sunshine family, which was, I think, the other analog.
I don't remember the Sunshine family. Was that also like a Mattel thing, or was it something else?
I'm not sure who made it, but they definitely had a very practical and wholesome van.
I love it.
So the outside world did come into your house a little bit, and I was just curious about, we were joking about you couldn't watch the Smurfs, and I mean, I know you didn't have Halloween, you celebrated harvest evenings instead. And
yeah.
I mean, my recollection from your blog was that you dressed up as Sarah from the Bible, which
right.
I'm sure was an awesome costume.
Yes. Yeah. And what is that, an eponymous costume? but Yeah, you know, and this was another one where I think in retrospect, I can see my parents, and I have a lot more compassion as an adult, again, for some of these things, you know, worrying that Halloween was going to, infuse, I don't know if it was, you know, be sort of like a celebration of Satan, of darkness, of evil. And as Christians, we didn't want to do that. So they wanted to steer us away from that. But they didn't want us to have nothing, you know, when all the other kids had something. So I think it was another effort to kind of strike that balance. And, you know, there were some years when I was allowed to dress up as like kind of innocuous storybook characters. I think I was Little Bo Peep one year, maybe, and I was a bee one year. I was supposed to be the Pillsbury Doughboy. You remember, you know, the puffy
yes,
white.
Of course.
And I was like three or four years old. My mother worked so hard to try to bleach, because this was like long before Amazon where you can get anything. This was like the 80s. So she tried to bleach out like a yellow footy pajama and make it white so that I could have like the white chef's costume. And she couldn't get it white enough. So I had to be a bumblebee instead. But, you know, so it's like, it's just sort of adorable as I think back on it, my mom trying so hard to, you know, give me these experiences, but in a more wholesome way that felt safe for them, right, for our family. But yeah, there was a year that I went as a Bible character, as Sarah in the Bible.
So. Yeah, I mean, the pictures that you have, you had a very Little House in the Prairie vibe, I'm just going to say.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, part of your education was attending these private Christian schools, K through college. And I mean, an interesting aspect of this, and you're well educated, obviously, but the Bible informed not just the theology portion of your education, but the scientific portions as well. And I wonder how you've come to terms with that at some points in your career as a journalist and as a student at the time.
Yeah, it was the word that just popped into my head was, it was an evolution. And I don't intend that as a pun at all, but it really was. I mean, you know, I remember as a young kid, and I describe in the book an experience I had very, very young where my parents took me to a seminar at church, which I think was modeled after or maybe even using materials from a guy named Ken Ham, who, if listeners are familiar with the young earth creationist movement, he's still a very prominent, influential leader in that movement. And, you know, there were slides and pictures and all these kinds of, I was very young, so I don't remember all the details, but just the vibe was that there, you know, here's a way to explain the world using the Bible, you know, using like the flood to explain fossils, the Noah's flood. And this very literal idea that, you know, the Bible says the earth was created in 6 days, and so it was. And there is this idea that was infused, I think, into that seminar and also into my textbooks particularly in my K-12 education and also to a large extent in college, that, you know, these ideas about evolutionary science were things that scientists had come up with really to try to deny God and try to, you know, avoid having to submit to God. And I believed that because that's what everybody around me believed and that's what I was told. And in a way, it was kind of exciting. It was like, well, we have this almost special knowledge that other people don't have, and we know how it really is, and we're kind of favored by God. But as I got older and I came to see that what the position that we held was such a small minority position, the consensus view, I came to realize, you know, just by going to science museums and seeing library books, and it's hard to not notice if you have any exposure to the outside world at all, that most people, most scientists accept evolutionary theory and see it as kind of non-controversial. And that started to kind of create a real sense of stress and tension in me, this idea that I was being told something that didn't seem to align with what most people believed. And it became harder as I became older and met more people outside of the evangelical bubble. It became more difficult to accept the idea that everybody else was just lying or misleading me or lying to themselves. And I, you know, I talk in the book about the one semester of my education that was in a public school setting was when I was a Senate page in 1998 in Washington, D.C. And during that semester, I went to school with kids, you know, from all over the country. And that was a moment where I kind of realized, again, like our science curriculum was based on the idea that evolution was just non-controversial. And that was, you know, a kind of an awakening for me. But I will say, when I got to college and my professors were all Christians, at least avowedly evangelicals, I was fortunate to have several professors who I think were open to my questions and some of whom would privately say that they themselves were skeptical of creation science, or I think probably didn't believe it at all. And so it was, you know, as I aged, as I got older and matured, there were just sort of cracks in a lot of the pieces of the foundation. And I slowly and gradually started trying to learn more. First, I was afraid of it. I was afraid that this knowledge would challenge my faith in some way I couldn't. And I just sensed that I might not be able to go back if I knew too much. But I also had this feeling that I needed to be open to reality. You know, I shouldn't, if I had to hide from information in order to hold a belief, that was probably a problem. And I think it was about, by the end of college, I was pretty convinced that what I thought about evolution was wrong. But to your original question, it was interesting, you know, getting into the working world, getting into, you know, a mainstream newsroom. And every now and then there would be stories that would intersect with something about science that I didn't know or had been taught something different. And I, you know, at that point, it was mostly just kind of exciting. It felt like there was this whole other world of knowledge that I had been closed off to that I now got to explore.
Mm-hmm. I mean, your parents raised you with a curiosity in a way. I mean, you talk about how you would sit down with your dad and talk about politics. And I mean, the outside world was coming in, but in a very filtered way.
That's a really good way of putting it. And I think, you know, this is something that I've talked to other ex-evangelicals about, but it's this idea that, you know, we were taught to seek truth. Mm-hmm. And maybe our parents and pastors and teachers' vision of what truth was different than the way I understand it. And I think we also have some really fundamentally different views about epistemology, you know, how we know things. Mm-hmm. But that said, we were raised to care about what's right and wrong and to try to make a difference in the world and to think about things that mattered. And so for all of that, I am actually really grateful.
Mm. Well, let's talk to some of our listeners. Joshua from San Carlos, welcome to Forum.
Thank you very much.
Tell us your story.
I was spiritually formed in an evangelical church right after high school. And I really came to like feel a call into ministry. And so I went to a seminary, despite the pastor telling me that it was too liberal at this seminary, and it was an evangelical seminary. And it was there that like I had opened my views about what the Bible was, you know, because I had been formed to learn that it was the inerrant, infallible Word of God. And when I started taking all of these classes in seminary, it expanded my perception of what the Bible is. And so I stopped going to evangelical churches by then, and I found myself in a mainline church. And I pastor a mainline church now in San Carlos.
Yeah, and I mean, that ability to question the Bible was formative for you, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it helped me deepen my faith, actually, because I didn't have to just go, well, that's in the Bible, and I being able to question made me focus my priorities more on Jesus rather than kind of the Bible being this final word. And I still think the Bible is authoritative for the Christian, but I just wouldn't use words like inerrant or infallible. And in fact, coming, you know, it's been so many years now since I've attended evangelical churches, it took me a lot of years to heal from kind of the trauma that I had experienced and to actually find the good that I had learned in those churches, because there was also a lot of terrible things. So, yeah, just.
Well, thank you for your call, Joshua. And Sarah, I wanted to pick up on Joshua's comment about the trauma of leaving the evangelical church, because you talk a lot about that in the book. I mean, departing from a faith tradition is one thing, but departing from a community that you've been born into or joined or raised into and, you know, sometimes having to fracture with family and friends is really difficult. Can you share a little bit about that and your experiences?
Sure. And I really appreciated what I guess Pastor Josh just
yes.
said about you know, rethinking the Bible, coming to understand more about it. I mean, that has been really fascinating for me, too. I think much like science, coming to a place where I felt like I didn't have to sort of squint to look at something, I could just look at it and receive the information and integrate it with my thinking without fear, was really healing, I think, to use a word that Josh used. And because it can be really, there's a lot of psychological distress, I think, in trying to wrap your head around something that increasingly creates cognitive dissonance, whether it's because things don't seem to add up or make sense, or because of the way either you're being treated or being asked to treat other people, you know. And so for a lot of people, I think those are some of the sources of that trauma. There's the sense that, I mean, it comes from a number of different places. It can be the sense that you will lose your community if you if you change your thinking, that the price of acceptance is an inclusion is agreement, which, again, is very painful if you find yourself unable to agree with certain things. I think there are sometimes, I mean, clearly, for some people, there are aspects of the theology that creates trauma. I talked to a couple of people who had, you know, real fear of, for example, the rapture, this idea that exists in some parts of Protestant and evangelical theology, that all of the Christians will be taken up into heaven with God at the end of the world, and that can happen suddenly and at any time. And, you know, for a small child like me and like others I talked to, for the ex-evangelicals, this idea that suddenly everything's just going to vanish and you're going to be sucked up into heaven and that's only if your, you know, heart is in the right place is really scary.
Yeah,
and really
terrifying.
Destabilizing.
Yeah.
And then there are experiences people sometimes have in the church that might be traumatic and or painful in any environment. I mean, certainly things like clergy sex abuse, you know, those types of experiences would be traumatic regardless of the context. But I think there's often another layer of trauma when it happens in a religious context where you are trusting these people with your very soul in many cases. And so that spiritual overlay from people I've spoken to, I think, can compound the trauma.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. Noah from Fairfield, welcome to Forum.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story about my relationship with my faith. I was raised Jewish, and for most of my childhood was in the Reform tradition, and, you know, had my bar mitzvah, celebrated holidays, what have you. And while I still feel culturally connected to Judaism, what really bothered me was the idea, this like constant refrain of being the chosen people. I was really uncomfortable with the idea that a religion, and in Judaism, you know, there's also an element of race too, which is, it's just deeply uncomfortable to me. And so while I still appreciate the Jewish faith and want to find a way to relate to that part of my, you know, family history, I struggle to understand, you know, how to make that work with my philosophy. And I think, unfortunately, in many other religions, that's true too, as the, as our guest observed. So, that's my comment.
Thanks for that observation. And I wonder if that resonates with you a little bit, Sarah, this idea that some people are chosen, you know, some people are going to go to heaven because they believe in Jesus within this evangelical tradition, and some people are not, and you finding discomfort with that idea.
It's interesting. I have heard from people from a variety of religious traditions who've resonated with the ex-evangelicals. And of course, I focused on my own because that's what I know. And because, you know, white evangelicalism has such sort of outsized political influence. But I think that this process of, you know, thinking about what you're taught within your own tradition, what your community says about itself and about the world, and sort of reinterpreting it, maybe reimagining it, assessing what works and what doesn't, is a really, really common, if not universal, human experience. And it seems like, you know, for myself and for others I've interviewed for the book, the end result of that process looks different for everyone. And for some people, it means maybe switching to a different tradition. Other people, it means, you know, really not identifying with anything at all. But for others who do want to maintain a connection to their community and their tradition, it means reframing it in certain ways and taking, you know, taking the good and letting go of the parts that don't work.
We're talking with NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd have left the church or organized religion, give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. More Forum after the break. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. I'm talking with NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, you're a political correspondent for NPR. You're covering the election right now. And you've said that one of the reasons you wanted to write this book was because watching the January 6th insurrection, you had some cognitive dissonance of seeing people marching into the Capitol with crosses and pictures of Jesus. And for you, that kind of brought an urgency to explain and maybe understand what was happening. It's a big question, but how would you explain Trump's support by white evangelicals?
You know, I think, well, early on in 2016, and I did some of these stories during the primary, certainly, and leading up to the general election, and lots of other reporters did stories sort of asking this question or asking questions that flowed from it. You know, would evangelicals really back Trump, and what did they see in him, and how were they dealing with the sort of difference between his life and the kind of ideals that evangelical leaders had been promoting for decades. You know, I remembered very well being a teenager in the 1990s and the way that many, many evangelical leaders, prominent leaders like James Dobson and others, talked about Bill Clinton's moral failures and the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. Mm. And it seemed like the tone around Trump was so very different. And I think a lot of people noticed that and sort of puzzled over that. But, you know, what I've come to I think, understand is, and this isn't in talking to a variety of evangelical leaders and voters, is that for most of them, it's not that Trump is someone they see as like them or embodying their ideal vision of a human or an American. It's that he's someone who can and will and has deliver on their ideological and political goals. You know, Pew put out some data within the past couple of months looking at some of these questions. And I think one of the most important takeaways was that of white evangelical voters who support Trump, only about 8 or 9% said they thought he was very religious. So they know he's not that religious. They don't see him as especially devout. And you'll hear them say things like, we need a president, not a pastor. Mm. God uses flawed people. Everybody's a sinner. So am I. You know, I quote Jerry Falwell Jr. From an interview I did with him in 2017 after Trump was inaugurated and after Trump had spoken at Liberty University's graduation. This was, of course, the university that his father, Jerry Falwell Sr., the evangelist, had founded, the late Jerry Falwell Sr. And Falwell Jr., you know, basically said everybody's got things. Everybody's done things. Anybody who says they haven't is lying, which, you know, in retrospect became quite ironic after we saw Falwell step down because of a scandal involving allegations of sexual impropriety involving his wife and so forth. He stepped down from the leadership of Liberty University. And so I think that bottom line, evangelicals don't see Trump as someone who is like them or embodies the way that they think they would like to be. They see him as someone who will do what they think needs to be done. And what they think needs to be done is bringing America back to a previous time when Christianity was more dominant, white Christianity in particular. You know, if you look at the data, the share of the population that is white and Christian has been shrinking for decades. And over that same time period, white evangelicals have become more and more aligned with the Republican Party, and the Republican Party has shifted, right? It's not even the party of 20 years ago. So I think those trends and pollsters like Robbie Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute, who looks at a lot of this data, has argued that those trends are deeply connected. Trump is a response to a changing country that makes many evangelicals uncomfortable, and he is seen as someone who can sort of right the ship in their eyes.
You know, Trump may be a sinner, but he's our sinner seems to be the kind of idea here. And I mean, his latest foray in having a Trump Bible, I mean, hasn't seemed to bother people either.
No, I mean, I think this fits right into that messaging. And in fact, when Trump, you know, about a month or so ago now, as I think probably all of your listeners recall, when he posted a video on Truth Social, his Truth Social account, selling this Bible for, you know, $59.99 plus shipping, which was not only a Bible, but had lyrics to the Lee Greenwood song God Bless the USA and also several documents, including the Constitution, all rolled into one. You know, he said Christianity is under siege and we're going to need the Bible to bring Christianity back. I'm loosely paraphrasing here, but that was the essence of what he said. And I believe Christianity is under siege is pretty much a direct quote. And so it fits into this theme that, you know, I was hearing in my Christian school and in my church decades ago, this idea that America was losing something. It was losing its Christian grounding, and we needed to go back to that. And so I think when Trump says those things, even when he says make America great again, it resonates with people who believe that about the country.
Mm. Let's go to Ryan in San Francisco. Ryan, welcome to Forum.
Hey, thanks, Grace and Sarah, for bringing up this topic. I think it was just a hidden message from God to have me listen today because this resonates so much with me. And I just wanted to call in and share my journey as an ex-evangelical. You know, both my maternal and paternal grandfathers were both ministers. I was raised in a Baptist Christian here in San Francisco. And, you know, throughout that time in my childhood, I was just, it almost felt like at this point as an adult, realizing that, you know, I just felt brainwashed. There were so many rituals and at the same time, so many contradictions and hypocrisies that I realized and was just told not to think that way. And that to think that way meant that I was going to go to hell for some reason because I was going against God and Jesus. And it wasn't until in my adult life when I was in a near-death accident that I came back and, you know, it was kind of like being born again in reality and really just having the second chance in life really made me understand and have this grow this one-on-one relationship with God. I still believe in God, but I've separated myself from organized religion and, you know, just with everything going on and just looking back in my past. I mean, I even spent a year at Bob Jones University and got myself kicked out because I didn't agree with the things that were being taught there and just the culture there. And so, you know, that's how deep I was into it. But, you know, my one-on-one relationship with God has just become stronger after that. I found that, you know, when you take away all the chaos and the drama and all of the things that are incorporated into organized religion, especially evangelical Christianity, it just felt better for some reason. And I've been thriving in my spirit, my personal life, my business has been doing better. Yeah. Like my family life is better. It's just crazy how God works. And, you know, I still believe that I even believe in new things. Like I no longer believe in the Trinity, but I still believe that God is God. I still believe in creation, but I also do believe that evolution does have its place in creation as well, that we are all evolving in that sense. And, you know, I don't have to have all the answers. And I think that's how God wanted our journey in life to be, that we don't have to have all the answers, but yeah, as long as we have our relationship with God, I think that's where it's all what it's all about.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Ryan. And, you know, Sarah, I want to ask you, I mean, Ryan has found himself a different spiritual journey after leaving the evangelical church. And you've talked to a lot of people who've done the same, trying to find a community once they've left this maybe a little bit more doctrinaire version of church. What has that been like for the ex-evangelicals that you spoke to?
I think it's one of the hardest things because church communities do provide, religious congregations in general, including churches, provide community. They provide a place to go and be with people and connect, which is such an important human need. And I think especially in, our modern era where we often are so dialed into technology and, a lot of people move around and they're not close to family, like it can be really it can be really difficult to find community and connection. And that's something that religious groups do offer. Of the people I've talked to, they find it in a variety of different ways. And many do describe a loss of that. So I don't want to paint it as necessarily easy. You know, for some people do shift into a different kind of religious community. Others, you know, I went to a church in Nashville that's basically an ex-evangelical church where people get together and they kind of have like an evangelical aesthetic with, you know, singing songs off the overhead projector and dressing casually, and there's a worship band, there's no set theology, and while there's a, you know, there are regular discussions of religion and especially Christianity, there's no requirement that you believe anything in particular. Now that's, you know, sort of a one-off, although I've heard, even since the book came out, I've heard from a couple of pastors who say they have, you know, churches where they're trying to be welcoming to ex-evangelicals. And so I think there are a variety of ways that people can find this, sometimes in religious places and sometimes in non-religious places as well. A couple of folks I interviewed for the book talked about finding community in art, you know, in meeting with other artists, and or even in, you know, nerding out around certain pop cultural phenomena like, you know, TV shows or movies. I think the answer is different for everybody. But the one other thing I wanted to say about Ryan's point is I think he's similar to a lot of people. You know, Pew came out with data recently about religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, you know, people who don't affiliate with a religion. And their latest research has found that a majority of people, even if they don't affiliate with a particular organized religion, still believe in God or a higher power. And many, you know, describe a desire to be spiritual in some way. So I think Ryan is far from alone.
Yeah, I mean, we did a show a few weeks ago about how people are seeking out that spirituality in nature, even. You know, people want community, congregation, but they might not want doctrine along with it. So, you know, finding those ways. I mean, in talking about ex-evangelicals, I mean, leading thinkers in the movement like Abraham Piper, who you quote, they warn against leaving one brand of fundamentalism to embrace another type. Like maybe there's this personality type of the hyper-confident thinker. Mm-hmm. I mean, tell me a little bit about that.
I think that is a real danger, and it's something to watch out for. I mean, something I talk about a lot, particularly as a journalist, is the fact that I think humans are just susceptible to groupthink, to wanting certainty, to being dogmatic about what they think is right. And I think it's important that people have strong convictions and try to do the right thing and advocate for what they think is right and true. But I think we also have to have a little bit of, you know, humility about our own sort of perspective, right? We all just have one perspective, one life experience, and this is again something that as a journalist I recognize all the time. You know, people have such different views of how things are based on how they've been raised and what they've lived through, what they haven't lived through. And this is why, you know, empathy and compassion and conversation and openness are so important, because it's not just evangelicals who are susceptible to these things by any stretch of the imagination. I write about them because that's, again, the group that I came from. But I think that those cautions are really important. And, you know, I think the reason people are drawn into sort of groups and dogmas is because it does provide a certain level of security and confidence, and that's very attractive and alluring. But I think sometimes that can close us off to seeing what we don't see and understanding what we don't know. And I think that's such an important part of living together in a pluralistic democratic society, you know, just trying to at least have empathy and understanding for people whose experiences are different than our own.
Well, you're listening to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. Jack writes, I remember 10 to 15 years ago, the evangelicals were strong supporters of environmental protections and earth awareness. Please talk about how and why this has changed. I mean, what's your take on that, Sarah?
I didn't write about that in the book. It wasn't a big part of my experience. I am familiar with the listeners referring to, and I know that there have been, I mean, I think one thing that's important to recognize is that there are lots of different kinds of evangelicals, and there are progressive evangelical movements. There are evangelicals who've been focused on issues like the environment and racial justice. And certainly, if you go back historically, there were evangelicals who were instrumental in the abolitionist cause to end slavery. So again, and when you're talking about a religious tradition that is so large, something like one in four people at its peak were evangelicals, and so influential. I mean, you're going to find within that a variety of experience and opinion and emphasis. I can't really speak to the environmental evangelical movement today. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know how influential it still is. But I know that there were, at least at one time in recent memory, there were evangelicals who were focused on that and talked about things like creation care and stewardship of the environment, you know, using language that evangelicals and other religious people would resonate with.
Well, let's hear from Kelly in Pleasant Hill. Kelly, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you for taking me. This topic is resonating with me heavily. My heart's been racing the entire program.
Well, thank you for calling.
The book sounds fascinating. Just wanted to share some of my experience. In middle school, I was avoiding my friend's culture of bullying and cruelty. It was terrible, and I found an evangelical church with some Baptist ties that was extremely welcoming to me and just really set me free from that really torturous school environment. So I was really drawn to it and brought in. And for all through middle school and through most of high school, I was growing in that space. But I basically started to discover that church wasn't the only place where there are communities of acceptance. I started doing community theater and doing high school theater and was exposing myself to that sinful, multicultural, multisexual world. And it reminded me of the trauma that was described earlier of that apocalyptic, framework of going to hell or heaven, whether you believe or not. And just imagining my friends all, you know, burning in hell while I was free to go to heaven was just really terrible for me and really traumatic for me. And that was sort of triggered the beginning of a step away from that. And that was really hard. But actually, what was most challenging for me was essentially coming out to my parents, saying that I was not staying in the church anymore, and just them knowing that now I was the one to have to suffer eternity in hell.
Wow, that's a lot. Kelly, thank you so much for your call. And it kind of leads me to ask a very personal question, Sarah. What is your relationship with your parents like now that you have left the church?
Well, I just want to thank Kelly for that call, and just I hope that you enjoy the book, because it does address that experience of It talks a lot, actually, about people grappling with their sexuality, particularly in, you know, evangelical environments, and that very struggle that you just articulated. And also that feeling of empathy for others who think differently, and that the fact that empathy sometimes pushes us to rethink things. To answer your question, I have, I have different relationships with different members of my family, and we're all kind of in different places. I've tried really hard to keep lines of communication open with my parents, and for the most part, they still are. But I think one thing that I have found, and that many others I interviewed for this book have found, is, you know, the importance of really clearly and kindly articulating some boundaries and sticking to them and saying, you know, there may be things that you just can't talk about with family members in order to preserve the relationship, if that is the goal. And for some people, it's not. It is for me. But I think, you know, that can be very challenging and very painful. It can create distance. But for, I think, a lot of people who've walked this path, many end up wanting to have some relationship, even if it's not a perfect one.
Well, thanks to my guest, NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon, author of The Exvangelicals. It was so great to talk to you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
And thanks to you, our listeners, for your calls and comments. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.